everyone who loves books. This is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the show all about books that belongs to you. I'm your host, Red Sale, and this week we'll be unwrapping some pre-Christmas treats. Narrator and author Andy Secombe tells me all about growing up with the Goons and gives voice to some characters of his own.
Okay, so it's a bit rough, but he's Italian, so it's a passion. Okay.
Yeah. I'm Robert Kirkwood, and I'll be talking to author Andy Miller about his year of reading dangerously.
These were all books I had told people I'd read when, actually, I hadn't.
And in an exclusive interview, Philip Pullman tells me all about his new novel, La Belle Sauvage.
I could see a longer story gathering, like a storm gathering in the sky, in the distant sky. And I couldn't help being intrigued enough to go back there and think about it and make it into a story.
That's all coming up on today's Read On. My first memories of Andy Secombe are of him and Brian Cant on TV in Play School and Play Away, and he's been keeping me entertained ever since. He's provided the voices for Colin the Security Robot in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and Watto in Star Wars. Impersonated his father Harry Secombe in a Goon Show special and the Lost Hancocks radio series. And he's even found the time to write half a dozen books. Many listeners will know him best as a brilliant narrator. So I started by asking him what led him to the RNIB Talking Books Studios.
That's a very good question. I'd sort of given everything up. I'd given acting up, or he's given me up. And I'd moved down to the West Country to write. And I wrote five books, none of which the RNIB have done. Anyway, that's a side issue. And I love it. I love writing, but it can get a bit lonely, just sitting in a shed on your own doing nothing. And then I got a call from an old mate of mine, an old radio producer called Dirk Maggs, who said, "Do you want to come and work for me? I'm doing a stage show. I'm doing The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, live on stage, with a band and lights and everything." And I said yes, as you would, given an offer like that. And it was great fun. And I found myself back in the entertainment world and thought, do you know, I've really missed all this. I've really, really missed all this. And so I started to get myself back. I got myself an agent again, and I started doing more and more voice work. And as I sort of put myself about, I discovered RNIB Talking Books. And people had told me what fun it was to work here. And also that it's very good experience, apart from anything else. And I thought, well, I'll try and see if I'm any good, because it's not something that everyone can do. People told me that many, many times, and I said, well, I'll give it a go. Even some very, very good actors can't, for some reason, satisfactorily read a book. But I sort of took to it and thought, this is great fun. And I've done, I don't know how many books I've done now, quite a few for RNIB, and I really, really love it.
And you've done some great titles. I've listened to many of them, and then as I went down the list, I noticed that you've done The Saga of Eric the Viking.
Oh, yes, yes.
Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them by J.K. Rowling.
Yes, 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 yes.
And recently, actually, I was interviewing Andrew Beasley, who wrote The Ben Kingdom.
Yeah.
And they're great fun books, aren't they?
They are. They're wonderful fun books. Well, they're quite tricky because lots of characters, lots and lots and lots of characters. And there are underground people and overground people, and it's sort of trying to differentiate between not only the different gangs but the members in each gangs. And, you know, you make them a bit gruff, or do you make them a bit light, or, you know, whatever you do. The Viking one was quite interesting because I think I made them all Scottish, and they had about sort of 15 different types of Scottish accent, which is got a bit confusing for everybody, for me included.
I suppose you couldn't really make them Welsh, could you?
Not really, no. A Welsh Viking wouldn't really work, I don't think.
Could start a whole new genre.
Yes, confuse a lot of people, I think.
And you've also done some fairly edgy thrillers as well. I noticed that you've done the Oscar de Muriel Mexican writer.
Yes, the Strings of Murder. It's not that's Scottish, but the Strings of Murder. With Nain Niels McGree. They were great fun. Yeah, I really, really enjoyed those.
Do you have a favourite book that you've narrated?
I suppose it would have been the first Nine Nails one, because it wasn't like anything I'd done before, and it's written slightly tongue-in-cheek. There are gags in it, and it gives you an opportunity as an actor to go slightly over the top, which I generally tend to do anyway, so it kind of suited my style, and I just had an absolute ball with it. When you sort of connect with something on the page, I think it comes across. I really, really enjoyed that.
Now, the one glaring omission from the Talking Books library, and I think from audiobooks in general, is your book, Growing Up with the Goons. Oh. You are, of course, Harry Secombe's son.
Yes.
Are there any plans for that book to be made into an audiobook?
Not that I know. I shall have a word with Rupert immediately. No, I don't think there are, unfortunately. It came out of a programme I did for BBC Radio 2. I thought it would be a good idea before all the sort of goon children decided to dropped off the tree, to sort of go round them all and sort of get their take on what it was like to grow up in that sort of atmosphere. You know, what's it like to be the daughter of Peter Sellers? What was Mike Benteen like at home? You know, I mean, was Spike Milligan was he a competent father? Was he a competent human being? You know, what was it like? I knew it was like for me, and sort of the abnormal was the norm, I suppose. It's very difficult because people used to ask me, what's it like? It must be very different for you growing up in that household. And my reply was always, well, it depends what your normal is. And for me, it's normal. It was normal for my, you know, father to come home at midnight, start singing opera and dancing around the kitchen. And we just had I suppose it was slightly mad. He wasn't sort of full on all the time. I suppose I found sort of similar experiences with the rest of the children. Cele Milligan has sort of christened all the children of the goons, the goon children. I think my sister Jennifer is goon child one. I think I'm either two or three, I can't remember. And we go on. There were seven of us in all, I think. Similar experiences, but for instance, Milligan's sort of seeming madness at home, apparently he was terribly, terribly organised and sort of fairly restrained presence in the house.
Did your father try the jokes, the gags out on you as you were growing up, or recount them? You know, you'll never guess what I did today at the office.
No, he didn't. But he did take us to see a goon show. Being recorded at the Camden Palace, just our road from here. When I first went to school, I would get this. I had never listened to a Goon show, and I would get the school teachers calling me Neddy Seagoon, and I had no idea what they were talking about. And I would have to correct them, saying, no, my name's Andy Seagoon. Yeah, that's right, Neddy. And they're and I had no idea that what they were on about. And so my father thought it was sort of time to find out what his daddy did during the day. So we went to see, a Goon show being recorded. And I don't remember much about it, except that I do remember seeing my father and chums on stage doing very, very silly things and talking in funny voices. And the audience howling with laughter, really, really, really howling with laughter. And it dawned on me, so my father's a professional idiot. Okay, I've got the measure of him now.
And you, of course, have had the rare distinction of playing your father or impersonating your father, not just once, but several times.
Yes. The first time was with Dirk Maggs again. And it was, he phoned me up. This I'd never met him before. This mad sort of Dutchman phoned me up and said, I don't know if you'd be interested in this, but I'm a huge Goons fan, and my one regret is that I never actually saw a Goon show being recorded. So what I'm going to do is record one. I went, oh, right, OK, good luck. And would you like to play your father? I went, I don't know about that, don't know. I said, let me think about it. So I went to see my father, who was still alive at the time, but very ill. And I went to see him in hospital. I said, I got this phone call from this mad idiot asking me to play you in a sort of cardboard Goon show. And he said, oh, you've got to do it. You've got to do it. He said the Goon shows were such fun. I had such a laugh with the Goon show. There was some of the best times of my life. You've got to do it. You really, really have a ball. And so I got back to Dirk and I said, my dad says I got to do it. And so we recorded it with John Glover and he'll kill me if I can't remember his name. I'll remember it. It'll come to me. Someone else. And we recorded it at the Playhouse Theatre, from where I think a couple of original Goon shows were broadcast. And we had an absolute ball. I mean, it was just fabulous. We had a 19-piece band, the John Wilson Orchestra on stage. It was terrific. It was really, really, really good fun. And the audience loved it. The audience absolutely loved it. It was what Dirk had done was he sort of stuck together two full-length Goon shows and threw in a few sort of greatest hits bits. And that's what we play. It was sort of based on the Phantom Batter Pudding Hurler of Bexhill-on-Sea.
Serious subject, that. It's,
Yes, and I played Neddy Seagoon, Hello Fox. Yes, and more recently, I was asked to play him in Hancock's Half Hour. The Neil Pearson has produced a series of called The Lost Hancocks. And four of which my father recorded when Tony went missing one day.
Yeah, which is something I never knew, that he disappeared, which presumably explains why they are lost episodes.
I think that the BBC wiped them in their
infinite wisdom.
Infinite wisdom. Yeah, Tony was working. He was doing about three different jobs, and I think he was just exhausted, and he had enough. And he walked off. He was in the West End doing a show in the West End, and he walked off stage one night and kept on going. And somebody phoned up the producer on the Saturday before they were supposed to be recording, and I said, "I've got tickets to see Hancock's Half Hour tomorrow. Is it still on?" The producer said, yes, as far as I know, yes. He said, why? Well, I've just seen Tony Hancock getting a plane to Rome. Oh, really? It's the first he knew about it. And so they got my father in a hurry. And he did four episodes before Tony came back. He was so successful that they actually, Gorton Simpson, wanted to change the title of the show to Seacombe's Half Hour. But Tony came back, strangely, rather quickly after that. And my dad wouldn't have done it anyway, because Tony was an old mate. He wouldn't have done that to him. But I sort of played him in those as well. They're being repeated this Christmas.
So I've heard, and I'm very much looking forward to listening to them. Did your father like the Goon show that you did? Did he get to hear it?
He never got to hear it, sadly. No, he faded quite rapidly. Him and Spike, actually. But they both had invites to come and see it recorded, obviously, but neither of them could make it through illness. And Dirk sent me a rough mix of it. Said, "Get this to your dad so he can listen to it." But he never sort of he was never well enough to listen to it, so he never heard it. But I told him I'd taken his advice and enjoyed the experience, and he was pleased with that.
Now, something else that you're famous for is the voice that you have created for a Star Wars character, Watto.
Oh, I don't know what you mean.
Yes, bring me your inner Watto.
To be careful who you say that to.
That sounds like one of the most great fun parts to play.
It was. It was. I had enormous fun playing that. It sort of came out of the blue. At the time, I had a small production company producing animation series. I mean, very, very small scale. Just me and a mate of mine. And we were both actors, and we wrote things and voiced them. There's a lot of stuff for Channel 4. And because we had a sort of a profile in the business, we got a call one day from Lucasfilms. And I said, yes, yes, hello, yes, Lucasfilms, yes, 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 hello, hello. How can I help you? And they said, who are your, we're looking for voice artists. Who would you recommend? You use voice people. So who would you recommend? Me. I said, me. I'm very good. I can do anything you want. What do you want? So it's okay. Would you like to come along and an audition? And so I went up to Leaves and Studios, and they had these little line drawings of Watto and Jar Jar Binks.
If you could describe what Watto looks like for some of the audience.
Watto is, he's got a face a bit like a tapir with a sort of a short sort of trunk. He's got a domed head. He's quite got a bristly chin, and he's got tusks. He wouldn't win a beauty contest. And his body is round and blue. He's blue, and he's got these stick arms and legs and wings, so he can fly. He flaps around the place,
and he talks in this very, very gruff voice.
But when I went to audition for it, they had no idea what they wanted him to sound like. So I said, "Well, can you give me some idea?" And they said, "Well, he's slightly dodgy. He's a wheeler dealer. He might have, you know, if he was on Earth, it would be he'd have mafia connections. Okay, so Italian in there, perhaps. And he's a kind of secondhand spaceship salesman." Okay. I just came up with that. Occurred to me.
Okay, so he's a bit rough, but he's Italian, so he's a passionate. Okay.
Yeah, and they liked it, and
as do millions and millions of Star Wars fans around the world. Yes, if you hadn't booked your place of posterity already, I think that part certainly did it for you.
Yes, I'll never live it down.
You're glad you didn't take Jar Jar Binks instead, are you?
Poor old Jar Jar. I think he's had very, very bad time. Ahmed Best, the guy playing him, was such a nice man, and it was such a shame that happened. But I mean, difficult character, Jar Jar Binks, to voice, and I mean, and I didn't come up with anything better than Ahmed came up with, so you know. I think anybody would have had problems with that character.
And actually, I understand from my children that the new growth area for voice actors is in the computer games world. And I believe you've done some of that as well.
I have done some of those, yes. I've done quite a few as Watto. I can't remember what any of them are called now, I'm afraid. Yeah, I've done quite a few as Watto. It'd be games where he's selling stuff, or he's teaching. He teaches fighter pilots, I think, and was sort of space fighter pilots. I've done quite a few. I've done a Broken Sword, which is quite a sort of a big epic. I've done three or four of those. There are quite a few. I mean, it's quite nice as a voice artist, you know, the sort of things keep happening. I mean, the media keeps expanding, which is great.
And are there any more plans for Colin the security robot from
Sadly, Hitchhikers? No. I loved him. I loved Colin dearly. For those who don't know him, Colin was a security robot, and he was very, very officious. He started out like this, and then Ford Prefect, one of the main protagonists of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, fiddles around with his computer chip and turns him into this really, really lovely, effusive robot who loves everyone. I just want to help. That was great fun. No. Sadly, Colin's gone the way of Watto, unfortunately, and never to be seen again or heard of again.
Ah, but we'll live on in repeats.
Of course.
You mentioned earlier that you are also a very keen and active author, and I think your books are, they're in the fantasy genre, aren't they?
Yeah.
Have you grown up being a fan of fantasy, or?
Yes, I was. My father was an avid reader, and we were encouraged to go and he had a library stuck on the side of the house. The kids were encouraged to go and choose whatever we liked to read. And I got stuck into my dad's Gollancz science fiction collection. I think he had every Gollancz book published. The yellow hardbacks, I loved the idea of just escaping. I grew up in 50s and 60s Britain, which was a really kind of fairly dull, grey time, and to come home from my dull grey school in my dull grey school uniform and open one of these books and be taken away to a completely different world, planet, universe was just wonderful. And I loved it, and I fell in love with the genre. And much later on, when I'd always been interested in writing, and around about the time when we moved to the West Country, I thought, well, I'm going to be wanting stuff to do, so I will try writing a book. And this book came out of me. It was a book about parallel worlds, basically parallel universes which collide, with a fight to the death between good and evil on Hove Bowling Green.
Well,
you know, as it does, and the main protagonist is a Hove news agent who doesn't know it, but he is actually a wizard from the magical kingdom of Limbo.
And the first novel itself is called Limbo.
It's called Limbo. Yeah. The second one, very imaginatively, is called Limbo 2.
Well, you know where to go looking after you finish the first book, then.
No mistakes. You wouldn't get them in the wrong order.
And are there plans for more in the series?
No, Limbo 1 and Limbo 2 were it as far as Limbo was concerned. I basically run out of ideas. And the other ones are completely sort of self-contained stories. The third one is basically all about a country house which happens to be the entrance to a wormhole to a different part of the universe. And a civil war that's raging on that side of the universe is about to erupt appear in rural England. And it's only averted by the work of a small rodent and a very stiff upper lip, a very starched butler. It's quite fun.
Andy Secombe, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On.
It's been an absolute pleasure.
For a full list of titles narrated by Andy Secombe, go to the RNIB Library website, rniblibrary.com, or call the Action Line on 0303 123 9999 and select option 5.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
Would you like to chat over the telephone with a group of like-minded people? RNIB's award-winning telephone social groups are small, friendly, and lots of fun. A great way of making new friends and a chance to socialise without leaving the comfort of your home. Telephone RNIB Talk and Support on 0845 330 3723 or email talkandsupport@rnib.org.uk.
You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and exclusive author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, I'll be talking to Philip Pullman. But before that...
If you're getting book tokens this Christmas, what will you buy? Perhaps the latest bestseller or a prize winner from 2017. Or maybe you'll decide to go back and read one of the books that you always meant to. Well, in a very extreme way, that's exactly what my next guest, Andy Miller, did. Nearing his 40th birthday, author and critic Andy Miller realised he's not nearly as well read as he'd like to be. A devout book lover who somehow fell out of the habit of reading, he began to ponder the power of books to change an individual life, including his own, and to define the sort of person he would like to be. Beginning with a copy of Bulgakov's Master and Margarita that he happens to find one day in a bookstore, he embarks on a literary odyssey of mindful reading and wry introspection. Books Miller felt he should read, books he'd always wanted to read, books he'd previously started but hadn't finished, and books he'd lied about having read to impress people. The Year of Reading Dangerously is read by Andy Miller.
I was sitting in Tiny Tim's tea room, reading the Communist Manifesto, while I waited for my mother to finish her shopping. "Can I get you anything else?" inquired the proprietor. "Just the bill, please," I said. "Right you are, comrade," she said. I paid for my bourgeois scone and went to wait outside. The book I was holding was not the little red book, but a slim, modishly designed paperback from a series called Great Ideas. Its cover blasted out the manifesto's rousing final declaration in embossed faux utilitarian type. "Let the ruling classes tremble at a communistic revolution. The proletarians have nothing to lose but their chains. They have a world to win. Working men of all countries, unite!" Standing in the street, book in hand, it was hard not to appear as though you were trying to make a point. I tried to adopt an air of intrigued neutrality and not burning revolutionary zeal. My mother arrived, and catching sight of the cover, uttered the reproach she still reserves for special moments of filial disappointment. "Oh, Andrew," she said. I slipped the book in my pocket.
"My name's Andy Miller. I'm the author of a book called The Year of Reading Dangerously, How 50 Great Books Saved My Life."
And did they?
Yes, 50 great books did save my life, in as much as I was in a bit of a rut, had a perfectly good job, commuting up and down to London. But after my son was born, I realised that I'd only read one book for pleasure in 2 years, and that book was The Da Vinci Code, which...
I shouldn't laugh,
but, lots of people have enjoyed The Da Vinci Code. I didn't really enjoy it. And I kind of thought, I ought to read some of those really good books that you think you ought to read, or perhaps that I'd lied about having read at various points. And so I ended up choosing things like Moby Dick, Anna Karenina, Don Quixote, but also things like On the Road by Jack Kerouac, Catch 22 by Joseph Heller. Some of those things that we might have tried to read when we were students or at school, or just felt we didn't have the time to get on with. So I made the time and I read them. And it had a big effect on me, yeah.
Nestling in my pocket next to the Communist Manifesto was the List of Betterment, which I carried round with me like Dumbo and his feather. The List of Betterment. The Master and Margarita, Mikhail Bulgakov. Tick. Middlemarch, George Eliot. Tick. Post Office, Charles Bukowski. Tick. Still to go. The Communist Manifesto, Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels. The Ragged Trouser Philanthropists, Robert Tressel. The Sea, Iris Murdoch. A Confederacy of Dunces, John Kennedy Toole. The Unnameable, Samuel Beckett. 20,000 Streets Under the Sky, Patrick Hamilton. Moby Dick, Herman Melville. Anna Karenina, Leo Tolstoy. Of Human Bondage, W. Somerset Maugham, and Pride and Prejudice, Jane Austen. In making this final cut, I had tried not to think too hard about what ought to be there and to let the heart take over. I only wanted to read books I wanted to read. Here, though, was the ink blot, the echocardiogram. What did the reading say? What did it say about me?
Now, if we're looking at audiobooks, fair enough, On the Road's about 10 hours, but Moby Dick's about 40 hours. That's a big commitment. Are you recommending it?
I must tell you, I have completely come round to the idea of audiobooks. For two reasons. The first reason was one of the books that I read was a book by Samuel Beckett called The Unnameable, which is a stream of consciousness, first-person narrative, which I read from cover to cover as a book, got to the end of it and thought, I didn't understand a single word of that. So I had another go as an audiobook because of Beckett's reputation as a dramatist, of course. And that was amazing and wonderful and very moving. So that was the first example. The other example is I was very fortunate to be able to read my own audiobook of The Year of Reading Dangerously. And people's responses to that as an audiobook have been completely fascinating and every bit as worthwhile as someone who's read the book as a paper book. And I've actually started listening / reading more books as audiobooks myself as a result of those two things.
And even with your own work, it's much harder work than you think it's going to be, isn't it?
I must say, I went into recording my own audiobook thinking this would be a walk in the park. I received a fee for it, and I thought, well, this is money for jam. Just sitting here reading. But actually, it nearly gave me a nervous breakdown doing it, because first of all, I wasn't very good at it, and we kept having to do retakes. But also, I kept reading things that I'd written and just thinking, I didn't read them and think, oh, I'm clever and funny. I read them and thought, oh, God, I never got that right. I ought to go back and fix that, but it's too late now. And so it took about a week, 5 days, 5 recording days to get it done. Yeah. By the end of it, I thought, I will never read or write anything ever again.
But did you get the little high at the end?
Yeah, I did, actually. And once I could actually summon up the strength to listen back to it with my horrible twangy voice, I'm really proud of it, really proud of it. And like I say, people seem to have really enjoyed it, so that's been a whole new thing for me, real thrill.
These were all books I had told people I'd read when, actually, I hadn't. These were books by authors whose work I was unfamiliar with the exception of Beckett, plays, short, and Austen, Emma, as a student, could not recall anything about it. Not that that had prevented me from giving the opposite impression often to myself.
Combining memoir and literary criticism, The Year of Reading Dangerously is Andy Miller's heartfelt, humorous and honest examination of what it means to be a reader. And I'm happy to report that some of the books in The Year of Reading Dangerously have been featured on The Talking Book Show, Complete and Unabridged, the shorter ones, that is. The Year of Reading Dangerously is available in print now, and it's available in audio from Audible and on iTunes. If you want to find out more and read a sample chapter, it's available at the author's website, which is milliam.com, MILLIAM.com.
Eye health tips for winter. Dry eyes are a problem when out and about in the winter, but indoor conditions can also have an impact. The lack of humidity with the heating on and windows closed increase the chances of drying out your eyes. A persistent watery discharge can be a symptom. People who wear contact lenses are more at risk, and constant use of a computer screen can also cause symptoms. So try to blink more often to avoid dryness. Over time, dryness can cause blurred vision or damage the cornea, so make sure you drink plenty of fluids and use lubricating eye drops to avoid dry eyes this winter.
Philip Pullman is a hugely successful and sometimes controversial author whose books are enjoyed by people around the world. Many of his books are available in a range of accessible formats from the RNIB library, including his best-known work.
Lyra moaned and trembled uncontrollably, just as if she had been pulled out of water so cold that her heart had nearly frozen. Pantalaimon simply lay against her bare skin inside her clothes, loving her back to herself, but aware all the time of Mrs. Coulter, busy preparing a drink of something.
His Dark Materials is a trilogy of fantasy novels set across parallel worlds. Its teenage hero, Lyra, must follow her destiny to discover the nature of dust, cosmic particles that fall to Earth and lie at the heart of religious belief in Lyra's world. Now, 17 years on, Philip Pullman is back with a new trilogy, The Book of Dust. The first volume, La Belle Sauvage, starts 10 years before his Dark Materials, when Lyra is a baby. It features a flood of biblical proportions, a pair of brave young rescuers, and a cast of sinister spies in a darkly brilliant odyssey of adventures. And I'm delighted to be joined by its author. Philip Pullman, welcome to Read On.
Thank you very much.
I know many people, including most of my own family, have reread his Dark Materials several times, but what drew you back into Lyra's world?
Well, in a sense, I never left it, because I've written two little books in between the end of his Dark Materials and the coming of this book. One was called Lyra's Oxford, and the other was a book which I had great fun writing about the first meeting between the balloonist Lee Scoresby and the armoured bear, Yorick Birnerson. Called Once Upon a Time in the North. So in a sense, I've been sort of living one foot in and one foot out of Lyra's world ever since I first thought of it. But I could see a longer story gathering, like a storm gathering in the sky, in the distant sky. And I couldn't help being intrigued enough to go back there and think about it and make it into a story.
It's set in Oxford. What do you think it is about Oxford that has produced so many wonderful writers of fantasy and allegory like C.S. Lewis, Lewis Carroll, Tolkien, and yourself?
Oh, it's something in the water. At least I don't see an explanation I can give. It's an unlikely sort of place. One of the unlikeliest things I ever heard of concerns All Souls College, which in about 1300 or 1400, I can't remember which, at Christmas time, was interrupted, or their carol service was interrupted, or something, by a duck that flew in. So naturally they caught it and ate it. 100 years later they decided to commemorate this, and they had a wooden duck on a stick made, which they followed around the college singing Latin hymns. And they've done it every 100 years since, except in the year 2000, when in the interests of sexual equality they had a female duck rather than a drake. So that's Oxford is the sort of place where that happens. The other attraction for Oxford, as far as I'm concerned, is that I live there and I don't have to go very far to look things up. And of course, it's got one of the great libraries of the world, the Bodleian Library, which I use extensively.
And I suppose it's also a confluence of scientific and artistic
thinking, all within a relatively small area.
That's certainly true. If you want to ask about anything in the fields of science or philosophy or metaphysics or there's an expert just down the road at the end of a phone call, and they're generally very, very helpful with their time and their advice. So it's a very hard place to go away from. I suppose the other thing is that once a little tradition has been established, then other people go there and add to it. I can't say whether I went to Oxford because of Lewis Carroll and J.R.R. Tolkien, but I probably wasn't surprised to find myself there because of that.
And is there any coincidence in the fact that one of the heroes of La Belle Sauvage is called Alice? Is it an echo of Alice in Wonderland, perhaps?
No, I didn't think of that until afterwards. And then somebody said, oh, you've written a book about it. Well, yes, I have written a book about Alice in a way. But it's a very different Alice. There's another connection. I mean, it involves a ride in a boat. And, of course, the original Alice began, the story began, because Charles Dodgson, Lewis Carroll, went out for a row on the river with a friend of his and with Alice and her sister, I think, the original Alice Liddell. So there's a sort of connection which I can't deny. But I don't think it was. I don't think I did it on purpose.
And the river plays an enormous and very fast-flowing part in the book. One of your Egyptian characters refers to it as the secret commonwealth. Mm. This is something that I believe you're going to explore more in the sequel.
Yes. The flood is very important. The book opens in Oxford, but the flood carries them away, carries our protagonists away, including Lyra, who's only 6 months old or so in this book. So the whole aim of the book is to look after Lyra, and that's what the hero Malcolm and his slightly unwilling sidekick Alice find themselves doing. But yes, the book does become, how shall I say, well, it enters Fairy Queen territory. I mean, Edmund Spenser's Fairy Queen, the immense long 16th century poem, which I never read when I was a student at Oxford, which I should have done. But I read since and found wonderful. And yes, the secret commonwealth is a phrase which I introduced deliberately into the book because that's the title of an odd little book by a man called Robert Kirk in about 1670 or so. He was a clergyman and he wrote The Secret Commonwealth. The full title is The Secret Commonwealth of Elves, Fauns and Fairies, as a means of writing down aspects of folklore, stories about fairies and fairyland and elves and semi-spiritual creatures like that, which I found fascinating.
Are you going to use that as a counterpoint to the organised religion under the Magisterium, which is still very much a part of La Belle Sauvage as well?
Well, yes. That's a fairly obvious way to go, but that's the way I'm going. One thing I learned in writing His Dark Materials was not to be afraid of the obvious. It was obvious, for example, as soon as I thought of it, that Yorick Birnison, the armoured bear in the first story, would turn out to be a king in exile. And my first thought when I came to that was, oh, no, that's obvious. Everybody else expects that. It's done before hundreds of times. But then I thought, no, this is what he is. Let's not be afraid of the obvious. So I went for that, and I think it worked. So I'm not going to be afraid of the obvious in this either.
La Belle Sauvage is the craft that Malcolm and Lyra and Alice use to survive the flood. It's also indicative of the fact that there's beauty and savagery in the book, maybe more so than in His Dark Materials. Is that reflective of a greater extremism that you see around you?
I think when I was writing the book, I'd have had to say, no, it isn't. It's just the way the story's going. But since then, and it's taken me a long time to write, since then I see that, yeah, it is in a way reflective of things that are happening in the world. The world has not become a kinder, softer, gentler place in the last 17 years. And I think that's going to come out more clearly in the second and the third book, even than it does in the first one.
Malcolm was the landlord's son, an only child. He was 11 years old, with an inquisitive, kindly disposition, a stocky build, and ginger hair. He went to Ulvercott Elementary School, a mile away. And he had friends enough, but he was happiest on his own, playing with his demon, Aster, in their canoe, which was called La Belle Sauvage. A witty acquaintance thought it amusing to scrawl an S over the V, and Malcolm patiently painted it out three times before losing his temper and knocking the fool into the water, at which point they declared a truce. Like every child of an innkeeper, Malcolm had to work around the tavern, washing dishes and glasses, carrying plates of food or tankards of beer, retrieving them when they were empty. He took the work for granted. The only annoyance in his life was a girl called Alice, who helped with washing the dishes. She was 15 years old, tall and skinny, with lank, dark hair that she scraped back into an unflattering ponytail. Lines of self-discontent were already gathering on her forehead and around her mouth. She teased Malcolm from the day she arrived. "Who's your girlfriend, Malcolm? Ain't you got a girlfriend? Who was you out with last night? Did you kiss her? Ain't you ever been kissed?" He ignored that for a long time, but finally Asta leaped at Alice's scrawny jackdaw demon, knocking him into the washing-up water, and then biting and biting the sodden creature till Alice screamed for pity. She complained bitterly to Malcolm's mother, who said, "Serves you right. I got no sympathy for you. Keep your nasty mind to yourself." From then on, she did.
Yes, certainly you have some unpleasant organisations within the book. I'm thinking especially of the League of St. Alexander, who are a cross between the Stasi and the Spanish Inquisition.
Yes, that's a very good way of putting it. Or the Hitler Youth, indeed, or the whatever it was they called the youth organisation in Soviet Russia. Bands of young people driven by a kind of ideology, by a zealotry, and encouraged in this wickedness by their elders. Yes, it's something I found pretty chilling.
Without wishing to give any spoilers, there's also a very unpleasant child molester in the book. Is he there as a reflection of the different ways in which youth can be corrupted, either by ideology or physically?
You could see it like that, but again, it wasn't like that to me, or he wasn't like that when I was writing him. When I was writing him, he was a villain. He was as creepy as I could make him. But as with all villains and villainy, it's more fun to write about them. You can't have people being good all the time. Well, there wouldn't be any story at all.
I know you're very against the labelling of books for age bands or, you know, what sex the reader is. But what guidelines do you impose on yourself when you're writing a book that you know is going to be read by children and young adults?
Well, that's the way I put it. I don't think this book is for 12-year-olds and upwards or whatever. I think this book might include, if I'm lucky, some young people and some older people. That being the case, the only guideline I impose is of telling the story as well as I possibly can. I think, though, yes, having an awareness of a wide audience, which is something I'm very lucky to have, means you have to be, I think, a little extra careful in your storytelling. You can't frighten the grown-ups too much, you see.
That's a lovely way of putting it, yes. And one of your, I think arguably one of your greatest inventions is the demon character. The fact that demons don't take their form until after a child has hit puberty, is that something to do with the nature and nurture debate as to the characters that we assume when we become adults?
Yes, it does. But I'm not specific about it because I want it to be open to interpretation and imagination too. I thought of the demon not at the very beginning when I first began this story. It was just Lyra going into a room where she wasn't supposed to be and things following from that. But I found that was something wasn't working. But as soon as I discovered she had a demon, at last they could talk together. And she could say, "Let's go." And he'd say, "No, we mustn't. And she said, "Oh, don't be such." And so they could talk and advise and console and frighten each other and excite each other and encourage each other. And it made the story work much more easily at that early stage. When I realised that the demon could change shape, I thought, well, yeah, that's interesting. But interesting in what way? What does it do? What does it tell us? And it didn't really tell us anything. Until I realised that it was children's demons that change shape, and adults' demons are fixed. That was the moment when I saw I could tell a story that I'd been, waiting all my life to tell, really, which is since my own adolescence,
which is the difference between innocence and experience, in William Blake's terms.
What form would your demon take?
Well, I don't know, but I think if I had to guess, she would be a bird, and she'd be a bird of the corvid family, one of those birds that steals things. The jackdaw of Reims, for example, or the magpie in the Tintin story of the Bianca Castafiore emerald. Wonderful, wonderful story. Or a raven, as in Edgar Allan Poe's raven. I think she'd be a raven, really, because the raven is the image of the trickster in many, well, North American myths, and of the storyteller, too. So I like to think that my demon is a raven.
I believe you based the character of Hannah Relf on somebody who introduced you to books and reading.
The character of Hannah Relf is, well, sort of some of the circumstances of her life, some of her way of proceeding is based on a friend of mine, Dinah Birch, who's a vice-chancellor of Liverpool University, as a matter of fact. But that's just the one aspect of her, one aspect of Dinah Birch and one aspect of Hannah Relf. The person who lies behind the story in a deeper sense is my old teacher, Miss Jones, Miss Enid Jones, at Ysgol Ardudwy in Harlech, where I spent my years from 11 to 18, my secondary schooling. She was a wonderful teacher, and she took an interest in me, I suppose, because I was passionate about reading and about books and about writing too, and I was very fond of her.
And it's a great gift to give anybody to introduce them to reading. The heroes of your books do fight back against injustice or threat. I can't imagine you think much of the snowflake generation.
That's an interesting question. I tell you one thing I don't think much of, and that's the word snowflake. Because it implies a sort of wimpishness among people who don't like tough things like right-wing politicians. If you're mildly left-wing, or if you're mildly liberal, you're a snowflake. No, you're not. What a ridiculous way of talking about people. I don't like that term, and I don't like the implication it has that if you're on the left or liberal or something, you're a bit of a wimp. It's not true, and I don't like it.
Yes, and it closes down debate and curiosity, which I think is at the heart of Lyra, Alice, Malcolm, Will. They are young people who learn as they go along.
You couldn't be more right. That's exactly correct. I was once asked, to my great surprise, to preach a sermon in the university church in Oxford. And so I took it terribly seriously, and I got the kit, you know, the sort of ribbons that go around your neck and the black cassock and all the rest of it. And I stood up in the pulpit, and I preached about virtue. And I talked about the seven Christian virtues, which, of course, begin with faith, hope and charity. And I said, they're all very well, they're all fine, I like them all, I approve of them all except faith. I'm not keen on blind faith. Instead, I'd rather substitute another virtue, which is curiosity. And I like to think that the protagonists in my stories do exemplify this. They are curious. They're interested in things. They're curious about where we come from, why we're here. They've got an intellectual curiosity, a metaphysical curiosity. They're curious about the world and the universe and why we're here. And I admire that and I enjoy it.
We're sitting in the RNIB Talking Books studios where audio copies of books are made. I believe you yourself read the His Dark Materials trilogy for the audiobooks and used actors for some of the parts of Lee Scoresby and so on and so forth.
That's right, yeah. That was a big production. It wasn't my decision to use actors in the parts, but I was very glad they did, although I wanted to do the bear. I always wanted to do the bear. And Sean Barrett did the bear instead. He did it very well. No, I was doing the narration, and actors were doing, including some of the cast of The Archers, which was a strange experience. Lissy Pargeter being Mrs. Coulter. But this time, I simply didn't have the time. It's a long process, as you know, and for someone who isn't professionally involved in it all the time, there are a lot of starts and stomach noises and mistakes and so on. So you have to take a lot longer than professional actors. And we were very lucky to get Michael Sheen to do the whole story this time as a solo, and he did it brilliantly.
Yes, it's a really compelling read. Were you involved in the decision to choose him?
Yeah, he'd got in contact with me and said how much he'd enjoyed His Dark Materials, very looking forward to the new one, and if there was a chance of having anything to do with the new version for TV that's being prepared of his dark materials, he'd be very interested in that. Well, at the time, they weren't hadn't begun that. But I did mention that to the producers of the audiobook that Michael Sheen might be a candidate, and he was kind enough to do it.
And will Michael Sheen be reading the sequel?
Well, I hope so, in due course. The sequel isn't ready to be published yet. It's written, but it's not yet edited and chopped about and cut and amended and so on. And I've got all that work to do before we can even think of publishing it, let alone making the audiobook.
Can you give us any indication of what's to come in The Secret Commonwealth?
Well, yes. I've said that the first book is, although it's set 10 years before His Dark Materials, is not a prequel. I just don't like that word. And the second part and the third part are set about 10 years after the events of His Dark Materials, but they're not sequels. So it's not a prequel and it's not a sequel, it's an equel. That's my one soundbite that I've been trolling around ever since I thought of it. In the second book and the third book, Lyra is going to be about 20. She'll be an undergraduate. And the consequences of the events and the ideas that are set in place in La Belle Sauvage will be a long time germinating, 20 years or so, but they will begin to sprout and then blossom and flower and produce whatever spines or thorns or poison they do in The Secret Commonwealth, which is the second book, and the third book, which I haven't yet written.
Are you a man who plans out your books, or do you let them grow as you write?
Oh, I plan them meticulously after I've written them. I have to write it first to see what it's going to be about. I don't know yet when I start. I've got to be surprised, otherwise the thought of working for 7 years to tell a story, all of which you know intimately already, it just chills the blood. I couldn't do it. I'd go mad. No, I do take them apart and put them together again meticulously after I've written them. I think that's the right way to do it.
Well, I will keep my fingers crossed for more armoured bears in the next couple of books. But in the meantime, Philip Pullman, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
And breaking news, La Belle Sauvage by Philip Pullman is currently being acquired by the RNIB Library and will be available for loan to members any day now. In the meantime, all three books in the His Dark Materials trilogy are already there, in a range of formats, including as talking books narrated by David Thorpe. Alas, that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and everyone who's been in touch. You can do so too by emailing readonair@rnib.org.uk. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not head to our Audio Boom page? All our past shows are there, packed with book news, reviews, and exclusive author interviews. You'll find a link on the front page of our website, rnibconnectradio.org.uk. Farewell until next week, and remember to read on. And from me, Red Sail.
And from me, Robert Kirkwood.
Have a very merry Christmas.
That almost worked.